from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll learn the purpose of a modern political convention, now that it's no longer used to find out who the nominee will be. Then we'll learn what Milwaukee's Tourism Bureau is hoping to get out of hosting the Republican National Convention.
The ultimate win would be an abundance of coverage where we are described as a wonderful host, because that truly does mean more business for us down the road.
We'll learn how pull tabs came to be a part of Wisconsin bar culture.
It's a very satisfying feeling of pulling those strips, kind of unzip them, and you see if you won a prize.
Plus, we'll hear new local music in Milwaukee Music Roundup. All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Political party conventions have been around in the U.S. since the late 19th century. They started as a way for political leaders to gather, plan, and coordinate, and most importantly, pick a nominee for the party. But primaries have made that last part pretty much unnecessary, since we know who the candidate will be ahead of time. To explore how conventions have changed over time and why parties still have them, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski is joined by Kathleen Dolan. She's a distinguished professor of political science at UW-Milwaukee, and she shares the evolution of political conventions.
So historically, political conventions were for the purpose of nominating a candidate for president, but lately, now that candidates are almost always a given, what is the purpose of a political convention today?
Well, Audrey, there are actually still several reasons that the conventions are important to the two political parties and their candidates. And these are things that also happened historically and are important today. So it's not so much that the uses to which the conventions are put has evolved as much as it is that we have sort of taken out the piece of the nominating. But political conventions are important to political parties because they are, if nothing else, massive information delivery machines. You know, to gather delegates from all over the country who are passionately committed to your cause and the energy that that creates is something that is catnip for journalists and for people who are in the, you know, general public as consumers of information. And certainly more so until the last couple of presidential elections. But one of the realities of conventions has been that they were really sort of the only game in town for almost a week. Things are a little different in the, you know, sort of multi-segment media and entertainment world in which we live now. And you may be too young to remember this, but back in the old days when we only had four channels on television and one of them was spending five nights in a row broadcasting a convention for 3 hours a night, it was hard to escape. So conventions want to capitalize on the energy of all the people they're bringing together. They want to communicate to the country all of the exciting things about their presidential candidate, but also their Senate candidates, their candidates for the House, governor, you know, all sorts of other people will get attention as well. And it's really sort of free media, right, for 4 or 5 days. Now, it is the case that the networks have pulled back on the amount of coverage that they give, freely on television every night. So in the old days, it used to be, you know, 3 or 4 hours every night. And, you know, sometimes we're seeing less of that. But the information is still there. We're seeing, you know, newspaper coverage. People are seeing clips on Twitter. So, you know, the upside for the conventions, you know, getting that information out is still huge. Beyond that, another very important aspect of the conventions, although this is sort of less obvious to the general public, is the writing of the party's platform. You know, it used to be much easier in the old days for political parties to have clear and consistent positions on the issues of the day. and the issues on which their presidential candidate particularly would campaign. And so there is a platform writing committee in both parties that comes together at the convention and literally writes the party's positions on, you know, 30, 40, however many different issues. And this, again, is about communicating to the public the ideas of the party, the ideas of the candidate, the here's what you're going to get if you elect us sort of manifesto. It is the case that in 2020, the Republican Party did not have a platform. They rode with the platform they had from 2016 in some ways, but they did not write a kind of fresh or unique platform in 2020. That's just sort of a side note. One assumes they're going to do that this year, but we don't know.
So with the candidates being presumed going into this, with the exception of VP for this one, what led to this change, this primary shift in a convention in that, okay, we know our presumptive nominees, but here's our finer details and here's us sharing our larger party platform with the public?
So the fact that the nominees for the parties is known ahead of time is a function of the shift that we have made since the 1960s to using the direct primary process to essentially elect party nominees. So in the old days, you know, when you always hear the expression, the boys in the smoke-filled back room, you know, conventions were literally the place where the party leaders would come together and they'd sit and stroke their beards and say, you know, who should we nominate for president? Who'd be the best Democrat or the best Republican for president? And then the convention would be the sort of like, you know, unveiling and the presenting. In the 1960s, we started on a broad basis, you know, sort of little by little by little, till we got to where we are today, using primary elections to allow voters to choose nominees for president, governor, senator, house, all sorts of locally elected officials. And the use of the direct primary is actually an innovation that was introduced in the system by the progressive movement, which has roots here in Wisconsin. And their thinking at the time in the sort of early 20s was, who elected the parties the bosses? Why did they get to choose who the candidates for office are? And so the direct primary is really taking the power away from party leaders to choose nominees, and it's locating it with the public. And so since the 60s, as I said, you know, over time, and certainly since the 1980s, we've used the primary as the primary way that we select nominees for office. And so that's why we know the nominee ahead of time, because the primary process in the United States runs from anywhere from like January to June, depending on how the 50 states and the District of Columbia lay themselves out. And then conventions are always held in the summer.
So as you mentioned, part of this progressive shift was to break the power of political parties over our election and governmental system. So can you talk a bit about how political parties are actually private organizations, not governmental units? Because I think when we take a minute to think about it, we're like, yeah, that makes sense. But maybe we're assuming the wrong thing this whole time, because it's a detail that's not really talked about.
No, that's exactly right. And I always spend a lot of time in my introduction to American government class talking about political parties and you know, the role that they play. And the first thing that we have to do is to recognize that political parties did not exist when our nation was founded. And the Constitution was written without any mention of political parties at all. Now, were there sides back when the Constitution was written? Absolutely, right? We've all seen Hamilton. And, you know, the earliest sort of sides we talk about as the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists. But part of the reason we didn't have parties right away is that George Washington was always assumed to be the first president. And so there wasn't a sense of competing for the presidency as an elected office in the new nation. And so it wasn't until after Washington voluntarily stepped down after serving two terms that people were like, now, you know, everybody wants to be president and now there's competition. So political parties have grown up over time, as I always argue, you know, as a natural human tendency to organize with like-minded people. But they are, as you say, private organizations that, you know, are registered and governed by law in the states and at the national level, but they have no standing in government or in politics, except to the degree that over time, our habits and our evolution have given them an enormously important place in both of those things.
So with this factor, does the political party themselves use their personal funds to host conventions?
So it is the case that in the old days, the parties would use their own sort of resources and their own people, you know, to put conventions on. Today, conventions, like everything else in American politics, are massive fundraising organizations. And so the parties raise money for the purposes of putting on the conventions. Now, that is their own money, right, because it has been donated to them for purposes, but it's not, you know, like the person who is the chair of the Democratic Party doesn't have to go out and, you know, make sure that the party has X number of dollars other than by raising that from other sources. I mean, certainly he or she's not going to have that money.
Right. So we've talked a bit about political conventions being just kind of a nice, wide, massive platform to share with the greater public. Do conventions typically have the impact of, say, swaying undecided voters?
So, as I usually say, it is theoretically possible, you know, that an undecided voter could happen on a convention and see or hear something that he or she likes and be convinced. But, you know, the issue about undecided voters in American politics is an interesting one. There are relatively few of them. And the primary thing in American politics that helps people decide for whom they're going to vote is their party identification. So individuals who identify themselves as independent or undecided are doing so in large part because they're not connected to the political parties in the same way that other citizens are. Since they are not connected to the political parties, they are less likely to be interested in politics. They're less likely to be consuming political information. I always say that political party identification is like being a Packers fan, right? I mean, you want your side to win. You want your team to win. You're going to wear the colors. You're going to go to the game. You're going to, you know, buy the swag. Being a Democrat or a Republican or a Green or a Libertarian or whatever your party is in the United States is no different. And so people who don't have that connection, they don't have as much motivation or interest in politics. So campaigns and conventions can only influence people if they consume that information. And they are much more likely to be watching Naked and Afraid, right, than they are the convention. So conventions are, in some ways, they are, as I said, massive information machines, but in some ways they are more mobilization of the base machines with, you know, hey, if we can pick up some people, you know, who didn't think they were going to vote for our candidate beforehand, all the better, that's gravy. But it's really hard to reach those people because they are self-selecting out, right, of most political information.
So we're talking about undecided voters, but is there any evidence that a political convention, whether it's the RNC or the DNC, can have a negative effect on their party's base performance in the city that hosts it?
So what I can say about that is that there is relatively little evidence that conventions have an impact in the state in which they're held other than economic. So certainly the bars and restaurants downtown are going to be quite happy, hopefully. But having the convention here does not necessarily give, you know, the Republicans an advantage here in Wisconsin. There's very, very little evidence to suggest that convention location matters at all. Could it have an impact in the city? You say negatively in your question. Again, there's little evidence of this. I mean, you could argue, I suppose, that Democrats in the city might be so mobilized, they might be so unhappy that the convention was here, that they say, we're going to go out and vote and show those Republicans not to come back. But that's pretty unlikely, you know, because the people who say those things were already Democrats, and they were already going to vote against the Republican candidate. So much of what looks like the impact of a speech or an event or something like that is actually not an impact of those individual things, because the people who are consuming that information are almost already always on your side. So unless there was some, you know, like horrific, God forbid, you know, violence or, you know, terrible thing that happened, I don't think most people will be remembering that the convention was here in Milwaukee, you know, by the end of the summer.
So given our short attention spans, is it politically and publicly advantageous to keep these going, conventions as a whole?
You know, that's a really good question. I think they still provide an important tool for the parties, again, to bring all those people together, right? Because all of those delegates and all of the party leaders from the states who are going to come in, this convention is going to get them excited and motivated and jazzed up to go home to all the states and to really dig in and campaign and try to get people mobilized. So it's an information out to the public, but it's also at some level an information in, right? I mean, they're going to try to get as many people in a room with the former president as they can. Ooh, I met the nominee. I took a picture. You know, they're going to talk to the governor's candidates, the senators, the House members. They're going to, you know, all of those people, we're going to, you know, like get to that fever pitch of Thursday night at the end of the former president's acceptance speech. And we're going to be like, let's go. So they do provide that role for the parties and its followers, you know, the elite, the kind of leaders. That is still pretty important, I think. I don't think we have a ton of information because we don't have a world in which we haven't had conventions other than the 2020 Democratic Convention that we could use as comparison. But I will say that I think political people believe that that in-person contact is important. But the issue is that they'll be here in July and the election is in November. And so there's not much of a lasting impact, right? I mean, like, you know, President Trump might experience a bump in the polls for a couple of days or a week after the convention, and then it'll settle back to normal and the convention bump, as we call it, will wear off. But it is, as you say, I mean, the way you phrase the question with the short attention spans, that's exactly what it is.
Definitely. Well, I appreciate all of your insight, and I thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, sure. Happy to be here.
Kathleen Dolan is a distinguished professor of political science at UW-Milwaukee. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. WUWM has an election survey where people have been sharing their questions about this year's elections and the upcoming Republican National Convention. One of the big questions we've been getting is, why Milwaukee? To get a better understanding from the city's perspective, WUWM's Mayan Silver chats with Claire Koenig. She's the Vice President of Communications and Advocacy at Visit Milwaukee. She shares why the city bid for the convention and what they hope the impact will be.
Why did Visit Milwaukee lobby for this convention to come to Milwaukee?
Visit Milwaukee bid on the Republican National Convention for a number of reasons. One being short-term economic impact, that $200 million in estimated economic impact that we think, well, we know our businesses still need. And especially when we were bidding, first starting to bid on this convention, which was all the way back in 2021, I mean, we were still in the pandemic then, and hospitality was devastated here. So we were bidding on every convention, but especially one like this that we knew would bring a huge short-term impact. And then because of the exposure that comes along with it, a massive long-term impact. And we're already starting to see what that can mean for us. When the Republicans announced that they chose Milwaukee as the host destination for the convention in July of 2022, inbound sales leads to our team have doubled since then, and they haven't slowed down. Those are real metrics pointing to increased interest from meeting planners who now have Milwaukee in their consideration set when they're looking for a host destination for any kind of convention for their city.
Can you just sort of clarify for people that don't know what an inbound sales lead is and what it means that it doubled? Yeah.
Let me back up by saying a little bit about what Visit Milwaukee is, just because that is, it were a new concept for some people, in part because our advertising to get travelers to choose Milwaukee, to get meeting planners to choose Milwaukee, is mainly to people not in Milwaukee. So if you haven't seen an ad from us, there's a reason. But we market the destination as the best place for a vacation, for a meeting, for a convention to people all over the world. We are, again, trying to position through media relations. So when National Geographic named Milwaukee the best place in the world for travel in 2023, that was not an accident. That just wasn't a lucky thing that happened. Our team made that happen. That's kind of our marketing and comms team, which is my world. Then we have our sales team. Their job is to fill hotel rooms. And one of the ways that they fill hotel rooms is by booking big conventions into the convention center. With the RNC specifically, we also knew we had this convention center expansion that got approved in April of 2020, and it's on our team to fill that thing. And so a big convention like this that was going to bring in trillions of earned media impressions at this point, bringing up awareness of this new expansion and all it has to offer. I mean, that tells meeting planners of all kinds, hey, this city knows what it's doing. They can organize to pull something like this off, and they have the facilities that our attendees expect. So inbound leads are something our sales reps receive through this program called Cvent, which is what the whole industry uses. And that software is where a meeting planner will put out a request for proposals, and they'll pick like San Diego, Milwaukee, Austin, Pittsburgh. And then our team receives that lead, and we either bid on that convention or we don't. So when we get more of them coming to us, that means they're already saying, hey, you guys are already top of mind. I want to see what you have to offer.
And is there such a thing as bad publicity that you're concerned about in any way, shape, or form? You know, there are people in Milwaukee that say they didn't want the RNC to be here. What do you say to those people?
I think, first of all, we're in the business of economic development. And that means we are bringing in conventions about a wide variety of topics. And sometimes those topics are controversial. We've hosted other controversial events before and other controversial major conventions before. And I think if we were in the business of picking and choosing along political lines, we would not get very far. And again, when we bid on this, it was post-pandemic. We were doing everything we can to get more visitors into our hospitality businesses to help them just survive. So for us, it's you know, one of the most popular phrases these days in Milwaukee. It's not red or blue, it's green. But we mean that. For us, it's about the economic impact and the brand awareness.
You're tuned to The Lake Effect. I'm WWM's Mayan Silver, speaking with Claire Koenig, VP of Communication and Advocacy for Visit Milwaukee. Remind me of the expected economic impact and how you come to those numbers.
So we estimate that it's $200 million in indirect and direct economic impact. And that's also an estimate. And using the best available data we have when we came up with that in right around when we were bidding, so around 2021 or 2022, we use what is the industry standard calculator for economic impact. People got pretty familiar with that phrase in the Bucks championship run in 2021 because we were talking about the impact of that a lot. But it's a calculator that takes some inputs like how many expected attendees, how many hotel rooms are they going to need, how many days are they staying, those kind of factors that go into planning any convention. It has some built-in assumptions, and then it spits out roughly what it thinks the impact is. It's important to note that the direct impact as a definition, is like the money that me, Joe, attendee, is going to hand to the bartender when I buy my beer after the convention is done. And then the indirect impact is the money that our businesses spend at other businesses to like accommodate this influx in guests. Those numbers also include, I think we use some data from the Cleveland Convention to just gather an estimate. Of course, we had some actual numbers from the convention planners at the time that they give out to cities, you know, bidding on this. And then, again, some assumptions are built into the calculator.
So how has the city, you know, essentially been preparing for this? I mean, it's coming mid-July. You know, what are some of the big steps?
Well, with the security side of it, with the city of Milwaukee, of course, leading the public safety side, the city of Milwaukee and MPD, and working with the Secret Service, and then a whole host of other like first responder partners, that they lead that. From the Visit Milwaukee perspective, one, acting as a connector. Once a convention books Milwaukee, we then have a whole team of people whose job it is to make sure they have the best convention experience yet. So what they do is connect convention planners with local businesses that can help them execute the convention. They help connect them with different city departments they need to like get street pole banners changed out or get flags on the bridges or, you know, those sorts of things. My team has, for this convention, I've been running a communications group with the mayor's comms director, county exec's comms director, the host committee, and the MMAC's comms director. It's an open invite to anyone who, with like communications marketing in their title. And the goal with that group has been to unite on some kind of messaging, like, hey, if we're all singing from the same songbook when we talk about Milwaukee, when there's 15,000 credentialed journalists here, we are ultimately gonna sound and look better if we're all on the same page. And then also, what tools and resources can we pull together amongst ourselves to give these media all the resources they're going to need when they're, you know, trying to crank out a couple stories a day about Milwaukee, about the convention, the scene, those types of things, with the hope of having the best possible coverage. In my mind, the ultimate win would be an abundance of coverage where we are described as a wonderful host, because that truly does mean more business for us down the road. So that's one thing. On top of that, we are trying to help our partner businesses. We have over 950 partners, and just help them like maximize what they can from this convention. And one of the ways we're doing that is with this thing called the Summer Savings Pass. We have done these deals passes before. It's like an app, but not really an app. It just sits on your home screen. It's totally free for users. It's free for businesses to participate in. And the businesses just offer a deal, and then you can go to, for the Summer Savings Pass, 60 different Milwaukee businesses and redeem whatever the deal is. Might be a BOGO thing, might be 10% off, whatever, but there's museums, restaurants, bars, tour companies that are offering things. And that pass is available for locals, visitors, doesn't matter. And it's also open all summer long, so it ends Labor Day weekend. But I mean, we just want these businesses to make the most possible money that they could. And so we are marketing the heck out of that pass, especially to these convention attendees. And then like people coming in for Harley and Northwestern Mutual and all the other big conventions and events happening the rest of the festival season throughout the summer.
Claire Koenig is the Vice President of Communications and Advocacy at Visit Milwaukee. She spoke with WUWM's Mayan Silver, and we'll hear more of their conversation tomorrow. If you have questions about the RNC, you can fill out our election survey at WUWM.com. What you tell us will help inform the stories you hear on Lake Effect and WUWM. In about 10 minutes, we'll hear some new local music in the Milwaukee Music Roundup. But first, we'll learn about pull tabs, a staple of tavern culture in Wisconsin. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. If you've ever been to a corner bar in Wisconsin, chances are you've seen a pull tab machine. They're a staple of tavern culture in the state, a form of light gambling that brings together families and friends while they share a pitcher and complain about the Packers. Writer T. Krulos is a freelance writer in Milwaukee, and he joins me to explore the history and legality of pull tabs. If you had just moved to Milwaukee, you've never seen one of these machines before, how would you describe it?
A pull tab machine. They're found in a lot of bars across the state, and you put a buck into it, or $5, and then you get a game piece, and you flip it over, and there's these strips on the back. And it's a very satisfying feeling of pulling those strips, kind of unzip them, and you see if you want a prize. And it's not going to be a big prize, like you're not going to be able to retire from your day job, but they typically pay out a few dollars. The maximum you can win on one is $250. So it's just kind of a fun thing that friends like to do at a bar. You get a bunch of pull tabs, you sit there unzipping them, seeing if anyone won, and a lot of times that money is just put into buying more beer or buying more pull tabs so you can keep playing.
Full disclosure, I would say about a month back, I had friends who were in town, one of whom is a Wisconsinite, loves pull tabs, and I did win $1.
A dollar. I was going to say,
pull tabs.
The most I've won is $2. So.
Yeah. which seems pretty standard, but one of the things that your article got into right away, which I have never really thought about before, is why are they legal? Like, for whatever reason, this had never occurred to me, but yeah, it is odd that they are legal.
Yeah, that's what started the whole story. My editor just wanted me to find out the answer to that question. And I found that the story behind it is pretty complicated, actually. It goes back to the late 90s. There was a guy named Walter Borer who was in the business of what they call coin-operated amusement machines. So he provided pinball and jukeboxes, stuff like that. And as sort of his retirement plan, he came up with Wisconsin Souvenir Melcaps, which is the pull tab company. And he created this by very seriously studying Wisconsin Statute 100.16. there are exceptions to gambling in that. You can create a sweepstakes. Right? So it is actually a sweepstakes. You can write to the company and they will mail you a game piece. But of course, most people prefer to play it at a bar while they're enjoying a beer. The other thing is if you can attach your thing to something of value, and this is why if you've ever played like McDonald's Monopoly, that's legal, is because you get some French fries along with your game piece. So Walter thought about this, and his argument is that on the front of the pull tab, there's a circular design, and that design can be cut out and saved as a collectible POG. So that is sort of the loophole, if that's what you want to call it, is that you're actually paying for this collectible POG, not the game piece on the back, necessarily. So he had to go to court because in the late 90s, he was raided. They confiscated his pull tabs, and he was like, no, you don't, because I actually put a lot of thought into this. So he went to court, and they admitted that, you know, he was in the right and that what he was doing is legal. The Wisconsin Department of Revenue is a little skeptical of this.
Sure.
From talking to them, and they're like, come on, really a POG? But I don't know. I don't think it's a bad argument. I mean, I don't think there's a lot of POG collectors out there, but people collect vinyl and VHS tapes, and I'm
people
sure there's collect POG collectors out there,
all kinds
too.
Of things. I used to and still have a small collection of potato chip bags.
Okay. See? Yeah. People love to
weird
collect
things.
different things.
Now, it does seem like there is a bit of fancy footwork in order to make them legal using this kind of idea of, well, you know, the POG, that's really this, this is what people are buying. But as you say, it was fought out in courts. Pull tabs won, ostensibly. Now, are all pull tab machines today, are they all legal or?
No, I mean, according to what I found, Wisconsin souvenir mel caps are the ones that are operating legally because they do follow those guidelines from statute 100.16. So other pull tabs that you see out there are probably not legal because, you know, they don't have that collectible feature. You also have to keep records of certain winnings. You have to clearly state the odds on your game piece. There's a lot of, like, little details that you have to follow. And some of those other companies are just kind of making, like, knockoff pull tabs, I guess I would call them.
Hmm. It's interesting to think about them in that context just because they're such a Wisconsin thing. I think they're also popular in some other Midwestern states, like Minnesota, yeah, for example.
Yeah.
But they are such a kind of cultural touch point. What do you think makes them so popular among people?
I mean, I think it works so well in Wisconsin just because the tavern culture here is so strong. It's most people spend some time hanging out in a bar, and this is something that kind of keep your hands busy, something social you can do with another person. There is that thrill, you know, even when I won $2, I was like, hey, I'm a winner. I won $2, you know. But like you say, they're very popular here. They're even more popular in our neighbor. Minnesota is the biggest state for pull tabs. And they do exist in other states. They usually have a different name that's more of like a localized thing. But, yeah, it's a big part of the tavern culture here in general.
Well, T, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me.
T. Krulos is a freelance writer based in Milwaukee. We spoke last year. Coming up, we'll get a roundup of the latest music from local musicians. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. It's festival season here in Milwaukee. With events happening nearly every day, there are a lot of opportunities to get outside into the community and hear some live local music. Matt Wild is the co-founder of Milwaukee Record, and every month he creates a list of some of the best new releases from local musicians called the Milwaukee Music Roundup. He joins me now to share a few of those songs. Matt Wild, thank you so much for being here once again on Lake Effect.
Well, thank you for having me back.
So this first song comes from a group, I'm guessing is from the Fox Valley, based on their name. And they're what I would describe as a very hard folk kind of bluegrass sound.
Absolutely. This is, I want to say a new group, but not really a new group, Valley Fox. Valley Fox has been around now for a couple of years, and they mainly play out live. And up until now, there has been no recorded record of Valley Fox music. Until just recently, they put out their first single, and it is called Roll On Mary. And you're very right. This is a very classic, bluegrassy, indie folk sound. It's got this real foot-stomping beat. It's got some mandolin picking, and it's got some great harmonies. The trio of Valley Fox is Joe Wace. I'm sorry if I'm pronouncing their names wrong. Tori Yakum and Laura Bomber. I've seen them a couple times here and there. I'm really looking forward to hearing the rest of their record, which I believe is slated for later this year. So look for a full Valley Fox record later this year. And until then, let's just enjoy their first single. This is Valley Fox with Roll On Mary.
I never
Valley Fox. Now, this next group seems very water-themed. Both the group name and the name of the song we'll be listening to are water references, and that feels fitting with their sound. It's that kind of expansive alt-rock music, but again, some kind of folksy themes in there as well.
Yeah, very hazy summer kind of music. This is a new group, or I should say a new musical project called Shorelining. The song we're going to be listening to, as you said, also water-themed, is called Currents. Now, Shorelining is a mostly solo project of a musician. His name is Jesse Harmon. And Jesse has played in a couple of bands. He currently plays in kind of a horror psych band called Zang, with an exclamation mark. And he used to play in a fantastic group in town called Piles. Apparently, and this was kind of news to both me and my Milwaukee record partner, Tyler, Piles broke up, and we're very sad to hear that. And so Jesse said that after the group broke up, he was just kind of bored and wanted to start recording some stuff on his own. So that is Shorelining. It is kind of the solo project of Jesse Harmon. And he's put out this great EP. It's really fantastic. And like I said, the song we're going to listen to is called Currents. And it's got, yeah, that sun-soaked, kind of hazy, very sparkling vibe. I really, really like this. This is a good kind of dog days of summer song and a great EP as well. It is Shorelining with Currents. Shorelining. Now, the next song maybe is keeping with a theme here. It also feels very alternative Americana, the same kinds of folksy instrumentation that we've been hearing, alternative country vibes, that kind of thing. Yeah, kind of a theme this time around, but I guess it's just that time of year for this kind of music. This is Old Pup. Old Pup, another kind of solo project by a Milwaukee musician. This musician's name is Will Hansen. And Will has been doing Old Pup now for a couple of years and has had kind of a busy 2024. Earlier this year, he put out an EP called Lion. Just a few months after that, he followed it up with the song we're going to be listening to, and it is called Spider Towns. And what I really, really love about Old Pup are the lyrics. I think Will is a terrific lyricist. And I just love the opening and closing lyrics to this song, Spider Towns. The opening lines are, hungover teacher puts on a movie in the dark, retires to the lounge. I just love that image. And then the final lines are, leftover pizza sleeps in the fridge until dawn when the lights come on. I just love those very kind of slightly surreal, very kind of impressionistic slice of life lyrics like that. This song is loaded with them. So really, really enjoy this and looking forward to hearing more from Old Pup. So this is Old Pup with Spider Towns.
Hungover teacher puts on a movie in the dark, retires to the lounge. Babbling baby spits up her noodles on the floor, cries. On the lawn when it's raining.
Spider Towns by Old Pup. Now, the final song that we have in kind of a complete twist, it is somehow the opposite of Americana. It's a kind of disco techno dance feel.
Yeah, I figured why not just mix it up here at the very end. And yeah, we're taking kind of a hard turn here. This is the latest song from The Quills. And The Quills, a kind of electro synth duo that's been around for a number of years. It's Becky Heck and Sage Schwarm. Both have been around the Milwaukee music scene for years and years and years. Sage used to be in the great Codebreaker way back in the day. For Milwaukee music fans of a certain age, you definitely remember Codebreaker. And him and Becky have been the Quills now for a number of years. And they have a new song, and it's called Wildcat. This song really, really gives me Tom Tom Club vibes. You know, the big Tom Tom Club song, Genius of Love, which has been sampled 8 billion times, continues to be sampled. It's definitely got that kind of vibe. I really, really like the song. It's a great summer song. I really, really like The Quills. They put out a really, really good covers album a couple of years ago that had covers of everyone from like Devo and David Bowie to Prince and even like Metallica. So The Quills, always just a good Milwaukee standby. They play out often. I think they're playing or DJing one of the Goth Barbie cruise parties or something. It seems perfect for them. So if you ever get a chance to check out The Quills, typically like at Mad Planet or something like that, that's the vibe, and they're always terrific. So this is the latest track from The Quills. It is called Wildcat.
Wildcat by The Quills. We are, of course, in really the middle of summer here, where it feels like everything is happening every weekend. What are you looking forward to this July?
You're right. We are in the thick of it. As we're recording, we're in the midst of the 19-week Summerfest season, and there's big, big things coming up. But actually what I'm looking forward to are the smaller kind of music series that take place in parks around Milwaukee. I want to give a special shout out to two of them that take place in Lake Park starting in July. It is Musical Mondays and Wonderful Wednesdays. And Musical Mondays especially are really, really fantastic. They do a great job every year of booking a very, very diverse, very eclectic lineup from like really all over the world. There's some really great world music in there as well. Those are on Mondays. Wonderful Wednesdays are a bit more family-themed for maybe younger kids. But they're both great series, and those take place in Lake Park, at the Lake Park Bandstand, the summer stage, I believe beginning in July. And just the continuing park series as well, things like Chill on the Hill, Washington Park Wednesdays, another Wednesday one. There's just every single day, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, there is some sort of park that's hosting a music series. So I'm enjoying all the big things that are going on now, but I'm also enjoying and looking forward to some more smaller things.
A lot to look forward to. Matt Wild, thank you as always for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me.
Matt Wild is the co-founder of Milwaukee Record. Every month he publishes his Milwaukee Music Roundup, and he shares a few of those songs with us. You can find our previous conversations at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand.
Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll explore Wisconsin's political landscape over the last few decades and its impact on national policies. That's tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.